You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Howdy, Doolanders. Welcome to episode number 19. How are you, Nick?
Oh, Blake, I'm a little flat.
Why, mate?
I'm just feeling pretty exhausted at the moment.
You had a massive October, didn't you?
Yeah, it was big.
You rode over 2,000 kilometres. What did you end up riding?
2,003 kilometres, because my math was not so great by then, and I thought, I'm not sure whether I'm there yet, so I did an extra three. And it was all for a great children's charity, the Great Cycle Challenge, which is run every year.
Yeah.
And 23,000 riders raised $7 million.
That is amazing.
During October. But it has left me quite fatigued.
You look a shell of your former self. Other than your nails, what's going on there?
I got a personal makeover by 5 and 6 year old yesterday who wanted to put me through the full treatment, and I said, no, you can do nails. Please don't comb my hair and dress me up in a dress.
I'm glad they didn't. Hey, given that you're so spent, you know, you're physically wrung out, you're probably mentally fatigued, and we're about to head out into the freedom of off the back of, I think, 500 cases for COVID-19. We're about to head out to the light. The world's opening up again here in Melbourne. Come with me, mate.
Where are we going to go?
Oh, it's a surprise.
Mystery tour.
It is. Blake's Magical Mystery Tour. Let's go. Oh, mate, how good are these hot springs?
I am melting away here. I'm one with nature.
You're not only at one with nature, we're at one with each other. And at one with our being.
I feel it.
I really. Well, you look it, but you look. You're looking. So
at the very least, my legs are feeling better than they have in a long, long time.
And that I can see that the energy is just flowing back into your body.
Yeah, it didn't. And look, the surroundings make it just that whole picture. It's amazing.
It is amazing. It's little wonder that our guest for today's episode. Episode number 19. It's a fair effort too, number 19.
It is.
Our guest has started up this amazing place, the Peninsula Hot Springs. Who is our guest today, mate?
Today we have the amazing Charles Davidson, the founder of the Peninsula Hot Springs.
Tell our listeners a little bit, just a teaser, about what they can garner out of Charles's episode today, and then after that I'd love you to just rub that coffee scrub into my back.
Guarantee that will not be happening. But Charles is a person who found out that not only could he do hard work, but he loved hard work. In fact, he thrived on hard work, repetitive hard work, and a number of these situations that he found himself in, he rolled it into something bigger and better each time that he did it. So his approach to life and his career and to now well-being, it's actually no surprise in hindsight that it all sort of panned out the way that it did. But geez, he had to be patient. And I think when you have an epiphany like he did and you're told by so-called experts in the field that in this case, there's no hot springs. There's no hot water, hot springs in Australia at all. It's too old, too flat. It's just not going to be there. But to just keep on pushing, asking the questions, and to finally realise your dream, geez, it's an amazing story.
It's a cracking story. So, listeners, Charles Davidson, he said to himself, I want to do something with my life. And I really want to make a difference. And he has. Absolutely. Here is Charles Davidson.
Now, just a quick note about this episode. We recorded this episode in early September 2020. The hot springs were shut down in March 2020 and are due to reopen today, Monday the 9th of November 2020. So good luck to Charles and the team. We also had a couple of audio issues that you might hear a little bit of scratchiness in there, but it won't take away from Charles's great story. Enjoy. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey, welcome, Charles, to the Doolanders. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, we nearly forgot someone. Nick,
how are you? How are you going? I'm here too.
You are here. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. Thanks, Blake. And good to see you, Charles.
Good to see you too, Nick.
Hey, Charles, you're a doer, an entrepreneur, and some years back you had an absolute moment or what you describe as an epiphany and a vision. And you've built that over the last, 20 to 30 years, you've built that vision from the ground up to create the Peninsula Hot Springs. So you're the chairman and founder of the Peninsula Hot Springs and the chairman of the Global Wellness Institute of the Hot Springs Initiative. Thank you for coming on. I would imagine that with everything that's going on in the world, you've need to be had your entrepreneurial flair more than ever before. Is that right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, right. At the moment, we are living by the seat of our pants. In a sense, we've been shut down for the second time. We have zero revenue except for some gift vouchers that people keep buying in the anticipation of coming again, and we have to reinvent our whole business model to be able to deal with, you know, how long will we have social distancing? How long will we have maybe a third or to a quarter of the number of normal visitors that we are allowed to have? We have to change our business model. So we have to be flexible and we have to look at, you know, all the options. So, yeah, we're at the height of creativity, and that's what adversity does. It pushes you to have to innovate or not. But don't innovate at your peril.
That's right. And look, we're going to dive deeper into, you know, what you've created in a moment, but what shaped you and who has shaped you over the journey? You know, you've told us earlier that your parents have had a big influence on who you are and how you do. Can you, you know, describe the influence that they've had on your approach to life and to business?
Yeah, sure. In my early life, both of my parents, in their own way, my father was the chairman of the National Trust. He was a lawyer. He was an entrepreneur. So he used to be he used to get involved with people who brought out musicians, and he funded it, but he also supported getting funding in to bring out people like, you know, oh, the Village People and Sammy Davis Jr. and Grace Jones. And, you know, so when I was 15 and 16, we were going to concerts with friends of these artists that, you know, and some of them were coming over to our house.
You know, who came over to your house?
Sammy Davis Jr. I met him.
Wow. You are kidding.
Yeah, I met Sammy Davis Jr. from the Brat Pack. Get that.
It
was amazing, you know?
That is, like, how many people in Australia could say they've actually had Sammy Davis Jr. to their house? You could just about be it, Charles, I'd reckon.
I'm sure we wouldn't be, because he would have been somewhere, but they, you know, when he came out. But yeah, amazing. At the age of, you know, whatever it was, 15, 16, 14, I think I was quite young, and incredible.
That is incredible.
So that was, you know, that having that around you and seeing my father, he was a lawyer. That's how he made his money. The National Trust was all his charity work. Wow. And these things were his passion. He was also the the chairman and on the board of the Mount Buller ski lifts, and they got Orange Lifts and bought Orange Lifts and did all the redevelopment and bringing in ski lifts. And he sat on the board of he was a chairman of an organisation in Queensland, which was one of the big tourism organisations there, which was a private company which ran, you know, Coconut Beach Resort and the butterfly enclosure and a few other things. So hearing that and just understanding the level of how much he could pack into his life, it just sort of sets a foundation for you going, well, what's possible in my life? You know, it was my dream and my life is my life and his life was his life, so I never needed to walk in his footsteps. But you always, you know, it's a great influence. On my mother's side, she was an incredible, you know, she went to university, studied and then married and then had kids. You know, like basically did the routine, but she had this huge entrepreneurial flair and she's always wanted all the kids to travel and see the world. And so she went off and started growing our farm on the Mornington Peninsula, started growing Chinese peas.
Right.
And she said, I'm going to sell Chinese peas to make money to pay for everyone's airfare. And she did. So she got all of our airfares and I was like six or seven, but we were young, but she went there and organized that and got that done, you know, tiny, but she had four kids, how you do that. And that gave one of the biggest influences in my life, which is the influence of travel, having had the opportunity at the early age of 7, 8 to go to Austria, to go to Germany, to go to Egypt. You know, we went around Egypt and Greece.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to see these ancient cities and ancient cultures and you know, just experience that at an early age gives you a real passion and it sets your, you know, it sets your life up in a lot of ways, or your influence in your life up.
Yeah, that's clearly it's in your blood. Being an entrepreneur is in your blood and being creative and I guess, you know, you're right. You can't learn the stuff that you've been exposed to in terms of, you know, seeing what your parents have done and the travel that you've experienced. You know, being an entrepreneur, from what I hear, it's bloody hard work. And you learnt early on from doing some pretty manual labour that you're pretty good at hard work. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of jobs in your pre-interview questions. You know, it made me think about, you know, what does set you up for understanding who you are, and usually that's adversity. So very often, you know, a lot of the high schools nowadays will be sending people off at year 10 to go off and do really tough hikes and tough walks and tough things. You know, when you're looking at hard work and you're trying to understand yourself and getting to understand what is it that who you are and am I, what kind of person am I, and am I a worker? And in my case, for me to understand, am I a worker? I learnt it just through taking on jobs. And one of the jobs was doing hay carting with my cousin. And I did it at the age of probably 15, something like that. And we would work from 9 o'clock at night until about 7 in the morning because it was too hot. This is summer work. It was once the hay was dry, summer work, and it was too hot in the Western District to be doing it. We had to pick up 50 kilo bales of hay and you'd cart about 1,500 of those a day, 1,500 to 1,700. And you have to handle them twice because you have to get them off the back of a truck and then you got to stack it into a hay thing. And I'd get, I think it was 5 cents a bale or 7 cents a bale. I found out later that my cousin was earning 15 cents a bale and he was paying me, he was subcontracting me. I actually, you know, it was just damn hard work, but I got fit and I ended up with, you know, $350 or something like that. And at that age, I thought this was just amazing. You know, I thought, wow, I've got my own money. He'd earned more than double that amount. So that's being an entrepreneur, right? And, But it, for me, it taught me that, you know, I can work bloody hard and I can pick up those 50 kilo bales and do it time after time after time, the repetitive sort of work. So that was, that was one. And then there was another job I did when I was at uni. I was saving up money to go with friends to go to Bali, you know, after first year, second year uni. And so I just worked for 6 weeks on one of those,
small jobs. I just got on the job board, and it was at this place called Loaders, Manufacturers and Traders. And they were based in, based in West Melbourne or one of near the wharfs in West Melbourne. And I basically cleaned up their whole place, and they were importers, exporters, a Jewish family. And, you know, you got talking to them, and I'm seeing what they'd got, and I'm thinking, oh, I could sell this to somebody. I could do, you know, and I'm having a talk to them. And the guy said, the way that you are, you work hard and you keep thinking about things, that you're going to be a millionaire one day. You know, you're going to do it because you've got the attitude, you know. And it was really interesting at the age of, you know, whatever I was, 21 then, 2021 at uni. You know, you don't know what's ahead of you. You got no idea, and you think that's $1 million. Wow. I mean, nowadays you need $1 million just to buy your house. You
know, like, that's right.
But back then, you know, I could have bought a house for, you know, 50 grand, you know. So it was a different time, and that was, you know, but it was that attitude and that spirit, and getting somebody to affirm, you know, to say that to you, it stuck with me, you know, and it makes you think, oh, maybe I could be, you know, maybe I could be something, you know. So it's sort of nice to, so if you ever have a chance to affirm people, you never know, you know, it makes a difference in their lives, you know, the little things.
Yeah, it sure does. And, you know, talking about that time at uni, was it at uni that you decided that you wanted to work in a Japanese trading company? Tell me it's not just as easy as waltzing in the front door of any Japanese trading company and say, hey, I'm here, I want a job.
I reckon the hardest thing in life, and that was, you know, what I got, was working out what you actually want to do. You know, like a lot of the time people go, oh, you know, I half want to do it. But once you want to do something, once it's there and it's there with a sense of passion and you know what you want to do, then it's just a matter of going out and doing it, you know. Like, so but the hard part is knowing. So this was my third year of uni, and it was the, you know, I think it was the first semester or second semester even, the third year of uni, you know, doing a commerce degree at Melbourne Uni. I was studying a thing called Asian Traditions and Economic Modernization, and it talked about lots of things about Asia. And one of the subjects talked about the Japanese trading companies, the Zaibatsus and the Keiretsus, and how the whole Japanese economic miracle happened. And we were just there, right in the heart of the economic miracle at that time. It was 1987. And you know, this is when Japan was at its pinnacle. They were buying, you know, buying the Rockefeller Center. They were buying New York. They were buying the world, you know, and they were buying Australia at that time. And, you know, I learned about these amazing trading companies, and it sort of combined a couple of things in my life, which was that spirit for travel and the international side, and commerce. You know, these were the ultimate commerce machines. The Mitsubishi at the end of the Second World War, it had a million employees. Mitsui, another one, had 2 million employees.
Is that right? I did not realize that.
They had their turnover was more than 50% of the world's population's countries, the world's countries.
Oh, wow.
The company's turnover. So these were just Goliaths. The Zaibatsus were broken up, which are these were the trading companies at the pinnacle of it, which were the brains. In fact, Mitsubishi, who I ended up working with, and I'll talk about how I got that job, but Mitsubishi means Mitsu is three and Bishi is diamonds. And that's the shape of the three diamonds. Now, Mitsubishi is a huge conglomerate.
Yeah.
You've got three main organizations at Mitsubishi. You've got the Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, which is the muscle, Mitsubishi Bank, which is the finance, and you've got Mitsubishi Corporation, which is the brains. So you combine the muscle, the brains, and the finance and the money, you've got it. And so I decided I was going to go and try and work for one of these trading companies. And they didn't have a recruitment program like BHP would have, or, you know, BP or all of these organizations which would come to the unis and try and grab their young recruits. They didn't have that. So I decided I just looked up the yellow pages, which is what you did back then, because we didn't have the internet, you know, like there was no Google. And I walked in the door. I just thought, well, I'll go and say g'day. And And I walked in the door at Mitsui and I just said, spoke to the receptionist and said, can I speak to your personal manager? She said, oh yeah, okay. You know, so she didn't get that very often. And then he came out. I had a chat to him for about 2 minutes and he said, you know, you should make an appointment before you come in and speak to somebody. And he said, come back another time, you know, and make an appointment in advance. And I go, yeah, okay. Sort of dusted off that and then jumped on the tram, or in fact, I walked up Collins Street because they were down the sort of Rialto end of Collins Street. Yeah. And then I went up to the top end of Collins Street and went into Mitsubishi's office, which was level 55 Collins Street, or level 45, 55 Collins, and asked to speak to their personal manager, a guy called, I know his name because I ended up getting the job, Brian Hazer. Spoke to him for about an hour. You know, I had a great conversation, told him about all the study I'd done and how I was passionate about it. And, you know, he could just hear, feel the passion. A week later, one of the Mitsubishi groups were looking for another staff member. And he called me up and said, come in for an interview. And I had 3 months left of my university degree. And they said, can you start? And I said, no, I can't. I've got to finish my degree. So they actually held the job for me for 3 months.
Wow.
And then let me come in. But it was, you know, like I was university. I'd done a little bit of hay carting, you know, sorting out. And yeah. I'd worked at Roland's Catering and I'd worked at, you know, O'Brien's Catering and worked at some pubs and did all this sort of, you know, the normal uni sort of jobs and stuff that you do. But I think it was just a passion. And the understanding, know the story that you're going for. You know, like in that case, I know what job it is or know what it is you want, then you've got a lot better chance of getting it. You know, and that's the hardest thing in life. Know what's where your heart's taking you and then do your homework. Mm.
I love that. Like it's that transference of your enthusiasm and your passion that clearly that guy bought that day and said, hey, we're going to have this guy because, you know, I feel it. I feel his passion and held a job for you for 3 months. That's cool.
It was amazing and the best job ever. That one, amazing job. I ended up in the food department.
So what was that gig all about?
Basically, it was international trade. So basically, people from around the world, whenever they wanted to source something, they said, oh, we want to get some ice cream or we want some cheesecake or we want some wheats or grains, or we want to buy powder or milk powder or whatever it is, they'd come to Mitsubishi, like this is in Japan, but we were exporting around the world, and they'd say, we want it. And then they'd come and ask all of the officers with industries that could produce that stuff, so around the world. And I'd get a text, and we came via telex, and then it was, you know, we had the those ticker tape people out the back, you know, it was that early. And then it was advanced. We got fax after that. So that's where we started off. But you know, I was on an IBM, you know, I was on a computer. So you'd literally call up the suppliers, you'd try and source people who have got that. You'd say, look, we've got this inquiry. We want, you know, 20 tons of cheddar cheese, or we want some ice cream, we want cheesecake, or we want asparagus, or we want salmon, or we want, you know, whatever it is that they wanted. Yeah. And we'd find it, but you'd be building relationships because you wouldn't want it just, sometimes it'd be a one-off, but most of the time it'd be about building relationships. And, you know, we're exporting wine and cheese and asparagus and salmon and all these different products.
Yeah.
I was the first person in Australia to export ice cream to Japan. I negotiated that contract and got it out of Peter's in Western Australia, small cup ice creams, you know, and that was an inquiry. And you just go out and you find the manufacturer, find somebody who's enthusiastic and wants the business, and then you've got to go through the whole back and forward, back and forward, back and forward that happens in relationship building to make it happen. But, yeah, just incredible, you know. Straight out of uni, I was dealing with export managers and managing directors and owners of companies. You know, it was just crazy good for understanding how the world works, you know.
Fantastic. And so tell us, like, in 1992, you describe it as you had a moment and you describe it as an epiphany. Tell us what happened. Where were you? What were you doing? What did you feel? And what went into your head?
Well, I was able to be sent across to Japan to go and work. I ended up realizing that the Japanese trading company had a glass ceiling for foreigners, you know, and I thought, well, how can I break through that? The federal government had a program called the Asia Pacific Fellowship, and I convinced our general manager of the Melbourne office to support me on putting an application in for sponsoring that, and that would get you to work in the head office of these countries and work overseas for up to a year. And they would pay 50% of all your wage, and then they paid an allowance for your food and your accommodation. And, you know, so it was a really big, you know, it was $110,000 grant, you know, grant basically,
yeah, wow,
towards support. So back then, it was big, huge. And we put an application in. We were successful. Then Mitsubishi had to have a huge culture shift because they had never had a foreigner working for their head office in Japan in the food department. You know, I had to be an employee of Mitsubishi Corporation. So I moved from Mitsubishi Australia to Mitsubishi Corporation and started working in Japan. And then part of the program was to learn Japanese. So I was studying Japanese. And when you study Japanese, or for me, you end up with a headache a lot of the time because you're trying to learn kanji, and it's sort of like, this is incredible. You know the dumbest person in Japan can speak Japanese and they read Japanese. But did I feel dumb? I mean, like, it is so hard learning kanji and learning the Japanese. But I was doing it, and then I had some people I was studying with, and they said, look, come on, let's go away for the weekend to a hot spring. And I said, a hot spring? What's that? And this is in 1992. I said, well, yeah, I'll come along for sure. And so we went to this town called Kusatsu. It was a couple of hours out of Tokyo in the mountains, and basically there was snow all around. It was in about March, so it was just the end of winter, early spring, but there was snow up in the trees, and we lay back in this hot pool in your birthday outfit, which is the standard in Japan, but you were outdoors looking up at these trees and snow, and it was just a moment when I was just felt this sort of oneness with nature. You felt so relaxed and so at peace, and and particularly when you come out of the water and your body's just like just at one. It's snow outside, it should be cold, but you're not cold, and you're just, it was just such an incredible sensation, that feeling, that all I could think of was, why don't we have this at home? Victoria, four seasons in one day. Like in Melbourne, it's just like horrible weather. Surely if we've got this, this is the antidote that we need, like for our long winters. So it stuck with me. I just thought, well, this is fantastic. Why don't we have this at home? And that became my dream.
So that became the dream. And in Australia at that time, there was no hot springs at all, right?
What I did was straight away after I saw it, I went to find out, is there hot springs in Australia? And I asked, I went and spoke to some scientists in Japan. So I actually followed up. I'm working for a Japanese trading company, but I'm following up. I'm enthusiastic. I've got to go and get the answers. And I spoke to a couple of scientists and said, who are hydrogeologists. And I said, well, what's the chance of there being hot springs in Australia? And they said, Australia, it's very flat and it's a very old country and it doesn't have earthquakes. Nah, there's no hot springs there. Nah. So this was their understanding, and they associated. This is just pure association, and it's actually not scientifically based. They were scientists, but they just thought, mountains in Japan, and Japan always has earthquakes, and we've got the gift of hot springs. So Japan is blessed, a country that is blessed with hot springs, and that's their uniqueness. But the reality is, since that time, I've been to over 50 countries visiting hot springs so far. I've visited thousands of hot springs. There are hot springs in every country on earth. The only one I haven't found is Norway. But I'm sure there are hot springs there. They just haven't, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it there. I'll find them there. They'll be there. But they're all around the world, and Australia does have hot springs, but I didn't think we had it in Australia, at that point.
Back at that time, right. And so for 5 years, that epiphany vision sort of rolled around in your head until – one day you're sitting in, you're drinking a VB in the in an office with Kevin Knowles in Japan, and what did he say to you?
Yeah, well, Kevin Knowles, he was the head of the Victorian State Office, and at that time I'd quit Mitsubishi, the trading company,
yeah,
and I joined the Australian Embassy in Tokyo because I wanted to go back. I went, you know, I was with Mitsubishi for 18 months at the first trip, and I went back, but I wanted to go back to Japan to complete learning the language and complete, you know, like I just didn't feel complete. So I quit Mitsubishi and then, yeah, got this job at the Australian Embassy. Similar sort of way, I had to find my way into that job,
yeah,
and I, you know, just kept on finding somebody on the inside who I knew, and then I just said, tell me when there's a job, and I call him up every, you know, month or two, say, is there anything here, is there anything, and about 12 months later, he said, oh, they're applying, you know, they need a new marketing officer, so I thought, great. And I got this job. So anyway, I was at the Australian Embassy. One day while I was there, I had a beer after work with this guy, Kevin Knowles, who's the head of the Victorian State Office. And he said, you know, you're a bit too entrepreneurial to be a diplomat. You know, what do you want to do with your life? You know, because I wouldn't quite follow the line. You know, I'd work my ass off. You know, I'd work and work and work, but you wouldn't necessarily do it. You know, they didn't want you to work as hard as I did, I think. So,
is that right?
Showing everyone up.
Something like that. You don't want to show people up. And
no. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, and he said, well, what do you want to be? You know, what do you want to do? And so I said, I'd love to do hot springs. That dream had never left me. That was 5 years before where I had that sort of epiphany. I had visited hundreds of hot springs after that because, you know, I kept on doing my study. And he said, you know, I think there's hot water on the Mornington Peninsula. And I go, what? You know, my family had been on the Mornington Peninsula since the 1850s, or 1842, actually. I had a farm there when I was young, so I knew the place. It was my backyard. And, you know, I was told there was no hot springs in Australia, and suddenly I'm being told that there's hot springs in my backyard.
In your backyard. Isn't that amazing?
It was just astounding. And I checked up, and sure enough, you know, the Department of Minerals and Energy had done test drilling right across the state. They'd come across this hot water. They were just actually looking for water resources, you know, testing to see what was where and, you know, what resources have we got. And they came across this hot water, and it went into a report, and somebody must have read it and thought, oh, hot water, maybe we could get somebody to invest in this in Japan. This was in the 1979 when that report was finished. Oh, no, the drilling was 79, the report was finished in 83. And then Kevin got the report a couple of, you know, a year later. And I walked through the door, you know, whatever it was, 18 years later or 14 years later, you know.
And so what was it about that stood out in his mind as being remarkable enough to remember that?
Look, it was probably just I triggered it, I reckon, because he said, what do you want to do? And I said, hot springs. I mean, how many people tell you I want to do hot springs for the rest of your life? You know, like that's what's your dream, you know. And so he just, you know, and he'd been in that position running the Victorian office for, you know, 20 years nearly at that point. So you've got the history, you know, and that's the thing about age and, you know, when the, you know, wisdom of ages and why you respect your elders and all those kind of things, it seems really strange when you're young. But when you get older, you don't forget things, you know, unless you've got Alzheimer's or there's some reason why you forget things. You do remember the snippets and you do remember, you know, you remember things. So, and that's the wisdom of ages, you know, the wisdom of you know, you tread Earth long enough and you understand Earth a little bit more, a little bit.
So after your 15 VBs with Kevin, how did you make the dream a reality? Like you learnt that they were, you know, in your backyard. What'd you set about doing?
Trying to write up a plan, realizing, you know, it was nearly futile. You're going, well, how am I going to start something? And I've only got my savings from, you know, 10, 11 years of working in 10 years at that point of corporate life. I didn't have that much, you know, like I wasn't a high flyer. I had great jobs, but they weren't high flying jobs. They weren't high, huge paying jobs.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I've got to get somebody on the ground at home. So my brother, I thought of him. He'd just finished running a florist shop in Collins Street, and he didn't know what he wanted to do in his life. And I said, well, you know, I gave him a call. And I said, well, he was coming to Japan, and he came and visited me in Japan. So I took him to a hot spring, him and his maybe fiance at that point, or maybe wife, I can't remember. But I took him to a hot spring, and having a beer after the hot spring, bathing, I said, look, I've found out there's hot water on the Mornington Peninsula. How about we go into business together? And he thought about it for a week or two and said, yeah, let's have a go. So that was, sort of about May, June 97. And by the end of that year, we found a block of land on the Mornington Peninsula, not far from where this old government test bore was. So we knew there was a good chance that there was hot water there. And, you know, you spend all the money you got on buying this block of land. And you know, I sort of have it as a bit of an analogy, like it's Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, like you say, well, what do? Do I build a house, or do I dig a hole?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was sort of what it was like. So we ended up buying the land, and then we went starting to try and dig this hole to find the liquid gold, you know, which is thermal water.
And talk us through that. I mean, the land size, you would have had to have just purchased whatever was available at the time. How close to this test site were you, and how big are these reservoirs of hot water generally?
The land size we were after, I went to the local real estate agent. I said, look, we want a block of land. We want it around this area. We didn't say what for. You know, you're not going to brief him to increase the price. But we basically said we want 10 acres or more, 10 acres or more, and we want it in this area. And the guy I spoke to, he said, Mike Prentice, and from Prentice Real Estate in Rye, he said, we had this block of land. It's 42 acres. It's not far from there. It's just come on the market. You know, it was only on the market a week or two beforehand, and it was, you know, it was about a kilometer away, so it wasn't right on the site. It wasn't perfect, but it was, you know, it was the right sort of size. And the people who had owned it was two couples who owned it. They were going to build a holiday house together on there, and they never got round to it, and they just put it on the market. Now, it could have been the block next door. In fact, where Moona Links is, the guy who used to own Moona Links, Bill Leslie, he offered me Moona Links for $1 million. He sent it to me on a fax to Japan. He said, "You want 650 acres with the house? No golf course at that point." But he offered, you know, I got a fax saying, "If you got $1 million, you can buy this property." And 650 acres on right down there. So,
what would that thing be worth now?
God. I don't know, 20, 30 million, something like that. But it's they've spent a lot of money, and I'm very happy that I didn't, you know, buy that. It would have been too much, and we didn't have the money anyway. I didn't have $1 million, you know. Yeah. Like, so we bought what we could afford. Ended up having, you know, 2 18-hole golf courses, a Moona Links built next door to us, which is not bad, you know. Like, and we're actually only going to just soon be able to take take advantage. It was not quite take advantage, but it's be able to really utilize the fact that we're living next door to each other. We have got a gate between the two properties. We've got a coded gate, and we've got accommodation, which is about to start at Peninsula Hot Springs.
Oh, nice.
And so we'll have buggies. You can go straight across and have a round of golf, and it's like having 2 18-hole golf courses next door to us without the cost, you know, building a golf course or running one. So
there's got to be a package deal there, doesn't there? Because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, 54% of the hot springs market Japanese and Chinese, and I don't know whether that is representative of the patronage at your hot springs, but they're going to go and play golf, and then they're going to come to the hot spring.
Yeah. Sorry, I was trying to get that connection. 54% of the global hot springs market turnover, so of the $56 billion turnover, 54% is represented in China and Japan. So they're the two largest hot spring markets in the world.
Right.
At our place, we probably have, you know, 10% Chinese, something like that. So we do get quite a lot. They're not usually they're Chinese who are living in, you know, Chinese Australians, and students, yep. And also people visiting friends and relatives. That's a really big, important market for us. So when you have a friend who comes over and visits and you want to hang out and do something together, you know, going to a hot spring is a really great option because you get to sit back and talk to each other. So you catch up with your old friend or your relative and you lay back in a hot pool and you just chat. And, you know, this is what you want to do when you catch up with an old friend. So, you know, you can go to a movie, but then you're watching the movie. You can go to, you know, you can get distracted on other things. This actually allows you to get distracted on each other in nature. So it's a nice setting.
Amazing. So you're right. I was fortunate enough earlier this year to go to the hot springs, your hot springs, and it is, you do feel absolutely present, absolutely in the moment. You can't help but not be. And I do remember spending a volume of time listening to people that had clearly had visitors from other international, other areas of the globe, and they were chatting about, you know, them coming together and spending quality time together. So it's such an amazing experience. But just winding back to when you started to, you know, started the business, you bought the land and, you know, again, incredibly hard work. Yeah, how did you keep the faith in the early days and keep pushing on?
Yeah, well, it took us 8 years from when we bought the land to when we could start to have our first customer come through the door and earn a dollar, you know, like, so.
8 years.
Yeah. Wow.
And how long did you think it was going to take?
Well, we'd hope, we bought it in 97, end of 97. We were hoping at that point that by the end of the millennia, you know, so that by the, you know, end of 99, by 2000, that you'd be able to open. So two and a bit years, seemed reasonable. Yeah, not. We took us 5 years, you know, there was all sorts of issues, drilling and financing and, you know, all sorts of things that, you know, nobody knew what you were trying to do and they didn't know hot springs. They thought we were complete lunatics.
Yeah.
Trying to keep the faith, look, probably the main thing that I did was, you know, you did ask yourself, well, I could go back and I was well qualified. I had a great degree. I'd had incredible job experiences. I'd worked in, you know, got fellowships and I'd done this and that. And so I could go back and walk into, you know, any large sort of food company or trading company and you know, you get a reasonable job. But it just wasn't in my heart. Every time I thought, will I go back to Collins Street and work up in one of the towers and do that job again, which I love the job. You know, don't get me wrong. There was nothing wrong with the job and being there, but it just wasn't in my heart. You know, I'd fallen in love with hot springs in that epiphany moment in 1992 at Kusatsu Onsen. I'd visited many more places since then and that had reaffirmed it. And I'd seen, you know, you kept on doing your research and every time I went to these places, they were as good as ever, you know, like they were amazing. And the dream of being able to, you know, do something with your life, you know, make a difference with your life. And you know, the trading was good, you know, that was good and you're doing something, but it just wasn't filling my heart. So, you know, I'd ask myself the hard question, you know, and mind you, I started off being a dickney, what I call a dickney, you know, double kids, no income. And then I became a trickney and a quickney. So I've got four kids now and, you know, and quickney, but it's a quadruple kids, no income. You don't hear about that very often. It's quite rare. You know,
it is.
To be able to have four kids and no real job, it was, you know, not really great. And I ran a little bed and breakfast. We moved down to live near the hot springs, bought a block of land right next door and started setting up a sort of an Airbnb type of hot springs experience. I called it Mizu Spa, which actually means cold water. So Mizu is cold water because it wasn't actually hot springs. I had to heat it with gas. But I made pools and I had accommodation and I had massage therapists and I had people there and I ran this sort of little bed and breakfast, normal bed and breakfast, earn around about 20 grand a year. I was earning 500 grand a year, not profit. This was turnover. I made no money out of it. I had 15 staff and I was just running myself into the ground. but incredible training. You know, like I did everything. I delivered meals. My wife was cooking, and then I had to take her off that because it wasn't so good for the relationship to keep her being the chef for four kids and trying to look after customers as well. It was.
I was gonna say, like, you don't do this on your own, right? Clearly, you got four kids. Your wife must be, one, a patron saint, and two is, you know, patient, or is she just on the journey with you? Like,
I'm nodding. When I just want to say that I'm nodding when you're saying, yeah, yeah. So it's like, you know, it was so tough. You know, like, you know, I was killing myself. You know, at that time, you know, literally, you're running yourself into the ground. And it was only for a year. If you've got a finite time, and it's a bit like the moment we're living right now in COVID-19, where it's the hard part isn't being closed down. The hard part's not knowing what tomorrow will bring. Now, we did that for 8 years, so you didn't know whether there is a tomorrow. I don't know if I've got a business. I don't know. And sort of exactly what we're living now is what we did for year after year after year. You know, Will I be able to still fulfill the dream? Will I be able to have my existence again? Will I be able to live a life? And, you know, it's really tough to live through that, and it's draining. And I had all the energy at Mizu, this little spa center, but, you know, what I thought, you know, about a year. I thought I'd be there for a year. We'll get the hot springs up and running. This will just be a training ground. I'll close it down. It ended up being 4 years. And eventually I had to move out of there because just with the kids and customers, and it was growing, and it was, you know, and so I moved out. I got managers in. I made no money out of it, but I just kept it going. And then, you know, we ended up starting the hot springs. So, you know, 28th of June, 2005, the hot springs finally opened. But also at that same time, we closed down Mizu Spa and just literally moved the bookings across. So any of the goodwill and all the customers and everything else just moved next door. It did take a lot of explanation to customers, and I still get it occasionally. Oh, those people next door, those people at Mizu Spa, they must be so disappointed. You know, when, oh, they must have been. That's terrible. You opened up right next door to them. You know, like, you know, it's like, you're the competition. I go, no, I am that person. That was actually my releasing my skin. You know, like, it was turning from a caterpillar into a butterfly, or turning from a shedding the skin from a snake, and you're moving to your next evolution. And it was and that's what it was. I mean, it was a great training ground, but, you know, hard work. You know, small is hard. You know, they say small is beautiful. It's small is beautiful if you have small ambitions and you live small. So it's all small. But if you have big ambitions and you're living in small and you're working towards something big, you know, it's exhausting. And the only way you make from small to big is to, you know, you got to let go to grow. You've got to be able to give people power, trust people around you, enable them to do the jobs, and stand back, you know, like, and stand back far enough. And I've still got to learn that, you know, as I move from, you know, going through my different phases of you know, business operation, where you're starting with, you know, no staff, to me being the only one, to 35 staff when we opened the hot springs, to now 350 staff. We've got a managing director now. We've got CEO. We've got CFO. We've got, you know, not managing director, CEO. We've got, you know, heads of all the departments, and I have to stand back, and I can't run it. And, you know, it's really hard. That relationship difference between an entrepreneur, and a professional CEO. You know, it takes a really, you know, important relationship that you're both not in ego, and you have to have a CEO who isn't just sort of like, you know, I'm the head of Alan Joyce, I'm the head of, you know, of Qantas. I'm a, you know, there are strong leaders who just run the place.
Yep.
And that doesn't quite work when you've got a CEO who's sitting next door to a chairman and a who's also the founder who started it. So I have to stand back, but he's got it. So there's a humility. There's this relationship thing. And that's, you know, that's relationships is what makes life. And everyone is different. So even though it's a textbook that says you should do it this way, you've actually got to do it in accordance with what's around you at that time.
That's an interesting move from an entrepreneur. I mean, obviously you get to a certain stage where, you either see that you lack a certain skill set that a professional CEO, as you described yours, could come in and add something that you couldn't. And that conflict between you, the entrepreneur, the one who started it, and handing over the day-to-day activities. Can you talk us through what it was like coming to that realization that actually there's someone else who can do that part of it better and still having to, you know, you still want to be part of the business, you still want to be visible, you still want to be, you know, getting that rush of, you know, being the next, you know, the creative and the innovator. How does that all work?
Oh, look, it's just how big can you dream? I mean, because I couldn't fulfill my dreams being in operations, because there's a certain extent to which there's a daily requirement. You know, everybody's only given the gift of 24 hours in a day. And even if you've got this amazing stamina and energy and you can live on 4 hours sleep a night, you can't live on zero sleep. You know, nobody does that for any extent of time. You might be able to do four, you might be able to do six, you know, whatever it is. But you find your balance, but you still got 24 hours in a day to play with one way or another. And it doesn't matter who you are. So the only way that you're going to achieve these bigger goals is being able to let go and then focus on what that big goal is. So, you know, for us, we'd go back and reassess what we're doing, what we're thinking of. Every 3 or 4 years, we'd rewrite our whole business plan. And basically, it's just that it's an exercise. It's an intellectual exercise of thinking, you know, and forcing yourself through habits to go back and reflect and go back and reflect. And we do it. We've entered nearly the tourism awards every year for the last 15, 16 years, 17 years, you know, since we started. We've entered the tourism awards and we've won Hall of Fame in three different categories, and we've, you know, failed in the first year, failed in the second year, but you go back and then you learn that area, whether it's ecotourism or whether it's spa and wellness tourism or whether it's tourism attraction or, you know, like you, but it's not done because you want to win something. It's done because you want to sharpen your saw, sharpen the, you know, you want to improve your knowledge. And you need some discipline to do that. You need to come back and be in a habit of going back and reflecting on what you're doing. And by doing those sort of processes, it sort of said to me, look, what do I want? And I'm thinking, well, I'd love to have, you know, a number of hot springs around the state. I'd love to see the culture of hot springs evolve around the country. I'd love to see the global culture of hot springs emerge. And for us to use this gift of hot water, which is something every country on earth has, and every person on earth, what they share is bathing, you know. So it is, you know, that everybody bathes. If you've got access to water, they will bathe. And it doesn't matter if you're Chinese, Japanese, Indian, or whatever nation you come from, you know, African, they've all, if they've got access, there's hot spring water, there'll be a whole culture around the hot springs. And it's a connector. And I see that the ability of it, you know, and this is from those trips with my family, my parents and so forth, over traveling in Egypt and traveling and around the world, where you see that, you know, the world can be at one, but how can it be at one? And, you know, you lie in the hot pools and everyone's suddenly talking to each other. Mm. And you found a place where people can be, you know, where we can be at one in nature and at one with each other. And that's become our purpose, you know, as a company, to create the spaces where people will co-create the spaces. So we've got to do it together. So the co-creation is very important, but co-create the spaces where people can relax in nature and with each other and connect with the wellness of their being and the deep well of their being, you know, and that is the possibility of our place. And second, we have a big dream like that, and it has expanded beyond just Peninsula Hot Springs. We go, well, how am I going to achieve that? How am I ever going to even open these other things? And I'm not going to open them if I'm running the place.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to enlist other people into the idea, into the dream that this is a possibility, that this is a real gift and it's our gift. And, you know, and harmony is not a distant dream. It's actually a current reality. You just got to be able to go out and grab it, and you've got to want it. And, you know, and that's my hope. And, you know, so with that as the dream, it's very easy to stand back and get Craig Mitchell, you know, amazing man, to be able to come to be our, you know, our CEO and, to help steer the ship. And, and you learn from each other. And, you know, none of us are perfect. You know, none of us have perfect knowledge, and you've got to give each other an ear and, give each other space. So you can learn from each other.
Yeah. Have you seen Australian culture develop over the last 15 years of being in operation? The term wellness is something quite recent. Mental well-being is also quite recent. I imagine in 2005, I'm not even sure whether they were even out in the open being discussed as important parts of especially Australian culture, different in other parts of the world.
Mm.
Have you seen that develop over the last 15 years? And you obviously play a part in that and you can utilise that. But have you seen that develop and where do you think it's heading?
No, look, the awareness of wellness and well-being, health and well-being, has been around for forever. I mean, you know, like we know that you need to get out and walk and need to get outside. It's formalizing that and putting it into a structure, which is where it's really really emerged. There are new organizations, so the Global Wellness Institute. You know, that didn't exist, and that started probably 7 years ago, but its precursor, the Global Spa Summit and the Global Wellness Summit, started maybe 11, 12 years ago. And that's become a driving force, but there's lots of them. There's lots of organizations that are doing it. I think it's just putting the language, you know, it's the language. When I was young, they had, you know, life be in it, and we had norm, and, you know, and that was about, you know, get out and be healthy. And,
yeah.
And you know, and even before then, it was sort of, you know, meat and three veg or something like that. You know, like it was, yeah. You get your vegetables, get your fruit and veg. You know, it was, you know, the food pyramid. I mean, you know, it's been around, awareness that it's there. It's getting the habits in. And it's that transition between, you know, the psychology of healthy living and, you know, and all the vices that are around us. I mean, we've got these vices and devices, the computers, the stuff that, you know, I remember when I first had to start plugging phones in every night, you know, like, you know, it was really frustrating at the beginning, and now you just do it and it's sort of just, it's become you, you know, you're nearly, you know, it doesn't give you the frustration. So, you know, I don't know. We're evolving, and I think they're saying right now that the three things that are going to come out of this pandemic are health, wellness, and technology.
Yeah,
that's what they're saying. Those are the three things that are going to lift up. That people are, you know, having time to think about, you know, their health and, you know, what they've got to do to maintain their health, and wellness, because you want to be proactive. You know, you know, the old health paradigm was about dealing with problems after, you know, like, yeah. Oh, I'm sick, now I've got to get a cure. Well, you know, we want to do it beforehand. Let's not get sick. Let's have that. Let's live a vital life. Let's live a life with great vitality. And the technology is an enabler. I mean, it's amazing. You know, like, you know, the space that you guys work in, it's, you know, it's such an enabler, and it can help people get into these habits. And that's sort of, you know, where that transition between what we offer, you know, getting people in nature and then getting into the habit of doing those things and the technology enabling it. But it's not a replacement for going out into the sunlight. It's not a replacement for lying in that hot pool with your friend and having a conversation. That all the technology in the world won't be, you know, a conversation with an old friend.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I tell you, we've heard and seen, I reckon what that guy experienced at Mitsu when you walked in the door and said, hey, this is who I am and this is what I'm passionate about. We've heard that from you. You describe what you do as it owns me more than I own it, which I thought that, you know, what a great way to live. Like, in terms of that's your gig and it owns you and you're really passionate about it. Like, I'm really interested in what's next. Like, you know, you talked about what comes out of COVID and what's the next dream? What's the next bit of entrepreneurial creativity? And for you, what are you thinking?
Well, we've got the immediate things which we're doing is, you know, introducing accommodation and doing cabanas and creating spaces where we can get, you know, people can, you can get people into our facility and feeling safe and giving them beautiful spaces. So we're just trying to enhance that experience and giving them, you know, high yield. So we're aiming that people can spend some more money so we can keep our staff on, because with third the number of visitors, we can't have the same number of staff unless we can get them to have more that they want to do. So stay overnight, eat some more meals, enjoy their own spaces, have some massages, have some, you know, enjoy some other facilities. So we have to reinvent our things immediately. We're working on a number of projects, you know, gaining the hot springs. I've really decided in my life, I get a lot of people asking me to get involved in other things, and I just keep going, no, I'm in hot springs. Yep. If there's not a hot spring involved with it, then I don't want to be in
You're
it.
You're not doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I sold my shares, on the year that I finished university, and I haven't bought another share, but I made good money out of the stock market. But I just realized when I was at uni that if I kept on doing this for the rest of my life, watching the price of shares going up and down and allowing it my emotional state to possibly be influenced by it, I'd spend a lot of years just watching the stock market, and I would allow it to run my life. So I decided that I didn't need to have shares. Not that there's nothing wrong with shares. I just, yeah. You know, it's a great mechanism for raising capital and building dreams. But it just, you know, wasn't for me. So you know, other things we're doing, starting another hot springs. There's one at Metung we're looking at building.
Cool.
So we bought the land and we want to start one there. So in East Gippsland. And we hopefully soon enough, I'm touching wood when I'm saying this, we'll be able to make an announcement in the next few, you know, weeks, or, you know, we'll see. There are projects in, you know, in other parts of not far from Melbourne. There's one more.
Okay.
We're working on some hot spring bathing trail work, where I'm trying to work on the culture of hot springs. So we've got a trail which we have been doing up through Western Australia, so from Perth right up to, it goes right up to Broome. So there are hot springs right up the coast there, but none of them have been developed in any form whatsoever. But you've got them at Ningaloo Reef, you've got them at, you know, Carnarvon, you've got them at, there's all of these, Dungara.
Yeah.
All these spots up the coast, there's hot water just underground, you know, they could pull it up and, you know, and then it's not being utilised. Same in middle of Queensland, New South Wales. So we've got another whole trail through, you know, Lightning Ridge, Walga, Pilliga, Moree, building a hot spring in a town called Cunnamulla. So yeah. we helped them get a $5 million grant. And I flew there a couple of times, drew some plans for them, and they got a $5 million grant, and now they're just appointing some architects, and they'll have a hot spring in the middle of the outback, and there'll be this outback hot spring trail, you know, and there's lots more of them. And then globally, you know, I'm the chair of the Global Hot Springs Initiative, and I just involved in helping build that global culture. And I'd love to, you know, there's potential projects in Japan. There's another trail project we're looking at in Japan. There's other ones in China, which we're talking to a town, Chongqing in China. They want to do this huge hot spring village, this hot spring wellness village. And their goal is to get 30 million annual visitors to this hot spring wellness village.
Wow.
So it's different. China's different. The scale is so different. But, you know,
mind you,
Australia's total tourist visitation last year, when you had a full year, was about 12 million people. That was all the people that came to visit Australia from overseas for tourism. It was 12 million. And that one town in China is looking at 30 million for this one hot spring development.
That's a mind-blowing different bit of scale, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, when you think about where is the best hot spring you've ever been to outside of the Mornington Peninsula?
probably the one that first comes to my mind right now is a place up near Mataranka, a thing called Bitter Springs. Mm. And it's just a natural spring, costs nothing to get into. You know, it's in the middle of the, you know, up from Darwin. It's probably, you know, 3 hours drive, you know, south from Darwin.
Yeah.
And you've just got this huge natural flow of water that comes down this stream. It's, you know, probably 34 degrees, something like that. And I went there with all my kids. I've been there a couple of times or a few times. And but I went there with all my kids and they were quite young and we were swimming in there and my son popped his head out and he said, "This is better than the Great Barrier Reef." You know? And you were swimming around and it's got this limestone base to it. You know, there's limestone rocks and it's as clear as crystal and you've got tortoises swimming around and you've got these birds flying overhead and it's sort of like, you know, it was just, you know, like swimming in an aquarium, but it was all a hot spring aquarium and, you know, free. So it was, but there's lots of them like that actually right across Australia, you know, and I'm still visiting more. If you go to Dalhousie Springs in the centre of Australia, that's actually the world's largest flow rate of a natural hot spring anywhere, you know, and that's, they say that whole complex there's about 50 different hot springs coming up in different locations in the centre. And that's, if you get a map of Australia and you put your finger in the middle, that's where it is.
Right.
You know, like Uluru is left of centre, you know, that's probably another 600 k's away. This one is actually right in the centre and it's got the largest flow rate. At the end of the Unadatta track and it's you come off the Simpson Desert and you come through from the Simpson Desert and that's what you come to, this oasis. You know, there's virtually nobody there and it's in the middle of nowhere, so it's not a metropolis in any means, but that's an incredible one as well. Yeah. So there's two, you know, and they're outback.
Transport us there. What I'd give to be there right now. Hey, last one. You've had an amazing ability to make stuff happen throughout your career. So your advice to, you know, those entrepreneurs, those budding entrepreneurs out there or, you know, people that are just pursuing, you know, their passion, what advice would you give to those people?
It's go for it. I mean, really, all you can do is follow your heart and you've got to work. Nothing comes easily. So you don't just say, "Oh, I want to make money," because it's, you know, money can come, but you've got to follow your heart and do something with purpose, really understand why am I doing it. So, you know, that sense of purpose and, you know, say I've got energy. You've got to put the energy in because it won't, unless you're persistent. And it's, you know, anybody who's made it in any career, you know, and I'm on my way. I don't think I've made it, but any sportsman, any person that's really made it, you'll find that they are hard workers. So if you really want to follow something, be willing to put in. And, you know, you've only got 24 hours in a day. You know, find time for your family, find time for all the other things, and you've got to do that. You do have to find time for your love. You've got to have the time for your caring. You've got to have time for your community. And so you do need to put those things in and make sure that they are the rocks that are put in there. But also realize that it's going to take, you know, it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of effort. But, you know, what else are we here for? You know, we're here for a short time and let's make the most of it. And if we can leave it with some more smiles, I mean, that's my greatest joy is to see that I'm leaving other people's lives better, that you can actually add to other people's lives. And that just goes, well, what else is there? You know? And what else is there in life if you can't, you know, leave some smiles?
Oh, I totally agree. Hey, what a great way to finish. Hey, Charles, thank you so much. We're really grateful to have you on the Doolanders and for you to share your story with us. Mate, it is so clear that what you do actually does own you more than you own it. Because, like, you know, we're sitting on Microsoft Teams here. We've got, you know, headphones in our ears and all that sort of stuff, but like it just permeates out of you. So thank you so much for sharing your story. I do have one last question. So Sammy Davis Jr. Walked into your household as a kid. Is there anyone famous that's bathed in your hot springs that comes to memory?
We've had quite a few. I had lunch with Paul Keating not that long ago, a couple of years ago. So that was quite fun because I really enjoyed his intellect and his use of the English language. You know, calling Mahatir a recalcitrant was quite fun because none of us knew what recalcitrant was. You know, like and Mahatir didn't either. You know, he thought it was a big insult, but it was actually, it was actually quite correct. But it was he just loved playing with words. So that we've had. Now, what's his name? Wolverine.
Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman's been there.
Not the first time Hugh Jackman's come up in a podcast of ours.
And Kate Blanchett's been in there. So, they've had, there's been lots. What's his name? One of the, I should remember, so I'm not very good with this, but one of the 007s, you know, one of them came, you know, one of the, one of the James Bonds.
It was Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, he came, but I mean some of them just rock up. Hugh Jackman just rocks up, you know, like and he's in the pools and all the women are going it's quite funny, but then you know, and Kate Blanchett was the same, she rocked up, but you know, yeah, when James Bond rocked up, he actually had his had it pre-organized, and we snuck him out the back and have a massage and have his own space. So
his people had to talk to your people, and through the back door he came. Right,
I think I found out the day later or something.
Right, hey Charles, thank you again, mate. Amazing story, super inspiring, and can't wait to see what you do next.
Beautiful. Yeah, well, look, thank you. Thank you very much. Blake and Nick, it's a great program you're putting on.
Thanks, mate.
Awesome.
Thanks, Charles.
What a great story. Hey, have you been down to the Mornington Peninsula Hot Springs?
Yeah, sure have.
Did they sneak... Who'd you go with, by the way?
Katie.
Just you and Katie?
Yeah.
Didn't take the kids with you?
No.
Wanted to relax, be
exactly.
One with nature.
I'm gonna be one with nature with those three kids.
Yeah, yeah. Did they sneak you in Pierce Brosnan style, or were you, just among the masses like Kate Blanchett and Hugh Jackman?
It very much among the masses. Although the last time that I went, it was one of those overcast days, but it might have been midweek, I can't remember. So we pretty much had full run of the show. It was great.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And that...
Just jumping from tub to tub, you go up to the top, you go down the bottom, you get in the cold one just to sort of see how you react.
Yeah.
You can't last very long in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is, it really, like, it takes me back to Charles's story when he experienced it for the very first time in Japan.
Yep.
And he had that epiphany that took years and years and years and years to come true, but that epiphany that said, this is what I want to do.
So the difference between Charles and so many other people is you hear people say, and I've heard it around barbecues thousands of times, I've got a great idea for a business. It's going to be this, it's going to be that, and people get really excited about it. Monday comes around and guess what they do?
Go back to work.
Go back to work, do nothing. Yeah. Yet... He was obsessed with that idea, and I would say that not many people believed him in him, because nobody else in Australia had tried to do it yet. They haven't even looked at that report from the 70s.
Yeah.
But he found out what was really important to him.
Yeah.
And followed through on it and was patient.
Oh, super patient. I reckon it was in his stock, though. Like, you think about him in his childhood. He got his entrepreneurial flair from his mum.
Yeah.
Yeah. How she said, I'm going to fund a trip for us and the kids overseas. You know how I'm going to do that? I'm going to plant a truckload of Chinese peas and sell those. And his dad basically taught him what was possible. Sammy Davis Jr. in your living room.
Amazing, right?
Unbelievable. The other thing that I was so impressed with Charles was just his ability to pursue. He was clear on what he wanted. You know, right throughout his life, it's been...
Until now.
Yeah.
He still says no. If it's not to do with hot springs, thank you, but I'm not interested.
Yep.
And that's quite amazing because someone with that entrepreneurial skill and flair, quite often you see people going, oh, yeah, I'll dabble in that sort of thing over there. I'll put a bit of money into this or I'll give my time and consulting effort. He's very firm.
He is. You hark back to his career prior to the peninsula or the hot springs idea. I absolutely want to work for a Japanese trading company. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just walk up to reception and ask for an interview or ask to speak to the head of HR.
Yeah. So that's what really struck me about Charles and something that I believe a lot of people might struggle with. He said, once you find out what you're passionate about, the rest is actually really quite academic. It's just you go out and start doing it. The hard part for a lot of people can be finding, well, what am I actually passionate about?
Yeah. Everybody needs that epiphany.
Yeah.
There was a saying that Charles had through the episode that really resonated with you. What was that one?
It was about the differences between the old health paradigm, which was very much focused on reactive remedies, whereas the new way of doing things is looking after yourself before things happen. And so that's all about getting into a habit of being well. And I really like that as a concept because definitely in the last 10 or 15 years, mental health, well-being in general has become something that's entered the popular mindset. Whereas Charles said, you know, it's always been there, except it just hasn't been adopted, especially by Western culture. But you can definitely see with our lives that, well, up until coronavirus, we're crazy busy running around doing a whole heap of things, working hard, kids' activities. Everything came to a grinding halt. You hope that as we come out of this, and Victoria is starting to come out of it now, that people take stock of these things and go, actually, my well-being and the well-being of my family and people around me is actually more important than ticking the next box to get to the next rung on the ladder or, you know, how you're perceived, I suppose, in your community.
The single most important thing is to do just that.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, geez, it's going to be hard, isn't it? Like if you're not feeling good about who you are and what you do, if your family's not, you know, feeling good about who they are and what they do or joined up, it just makes it harder and harder. Hey, last one. If I said to you, Nick, how about we go and start this business? Oh, and it's only going to take 8 years. 8 years it took Charles to get – he bought the land and then 8 years later – he cuts the ribbon on the opening. The blood, sweat, tears, the ability to stay the course and pursue his passion is just so impressive, so admirable. And clearly he didn't do it on his own. He had his brother with him and his wife and family. Just so impressive to continue to pursue his passion day after day after day for 8 years to get the thing done.
And to cut his teeth essentially is a break-even type exercise, running that B&B to get to know how to run, you know, different sorts of wellness centres and to deal with hospitality, all those sorts of things. He knew what he wanted to get in the long run. The final sort of thing to talk about Charles is his approach to time management and his expectations of what you can get out of any given day. Obviously, you need a little bit of sleep. Very few people can function on less than a few hours of sleep. But his mindset of what else are you here for? If you're not going to pursue your passion or if you're not going to, you know, find time for your friends and family, what are you really here for? And I think that's fantastic. And he's just so ultra-focused. And you know that him, what he stands for is hot springs and everything that comes with that. There's no diversion. It is, I'm focused on this single thing. And ultimately, that's why he's so successful.
Nick, I think everyone who listens to the Doolanders should get down to the peninsula. Tricky if they're interstate or overseas, but those that are based in Melbourne should get down to the peninsula and enjoy and experience this epiphany and this dream of Charles's. Tell us some good news.
It's open.
Yes, it's open.
Monday, November 9, it's open for business. So get down there. Buy gift vouchers for your friends and family for Christmas so they can enjoy a treat for themselves. And when you're sitting back in the spas, just take a couple of minutes to think that this wasn't some mega organization or corporation that thought about bringing hot springs to the peninsula. It was one man sitting in an onsen in Japan who just came up with the idea, and that is how everything you see in front of you right now at the Peninsula Hot Springs came to light.
Such an inspiring story. That's all we've got time for on this week's episode. Can't wait to do with you next week, Nick.
Bye for now.
Hey, Doolanders. If you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...